Coming up, we're going to hear first from several Christians, pastors. One is also a state representative from Texas. They're going to talk about Christian nationalism. So first up, James Tallarico. Following him, Reverend Stephen Anderson. And then a short little historical note by Christine Hayes. She's going to help us distinguish between the terms Israeli and Israelite. Next, we're going to hear a long documentary from Al Jazeera about the Stern Gang, one of the terrorist gangs that was involved in the creation of the State of Israel. And finally, we'll hear from Rich Forer, and he's going to share his journey from being an AIPAC Zionist to being a pro-Palestinian activist. So first up, James Del Tallarico, state representative from Texas and also a Baptist pastor.
My granddad was a Baptist preacher. I've been a member of this church since I was 2 years old. And now I'm in seminary studying to become a minister myself. My faith means more to me than anything. But if I'm being very honest, sometimes I hesitate before telling someone I'm a Christian. There is a cancer on our religion. Until we confess the sin that is Christian nationalism and exorcise it from our churches, our religion can do a lot more damage than a six-pack of Lone Star. There is nothing Christian about Christian nationalism. It is the worship of power, social power, economic power, political power in the name of Christ. And it is a betrayal of Jesus of Nazareth. He told us we would know them by their fruits. Jesus includes, Christian nationalism excludes. Jesus liberates, Christian nationalism controls. Jesus saves, Christian nationalism kills. Jesus started a universal movement based on mutual love. Christian nationalism is a sectarian movement based on mutual hate. Jesus came to transform the world. Christian nationalism is here to maintain the status quo. They have co-opted the Son of God. They've turned this humble rabbi into a gun-toting, gay-bashing, science-denying, money-loving, fear-mongering fascist. And it is incumbent upon all Christians to confront it and denounce it.
Amen.
How did this happen? The first followers of Jesus didn't call themselves Christians. They called themselves the Way. Their crucified teacher taught them a different way of being human, and they intended to follow it. The early church was a revolutionary community built on radical love, a peculiar people who shared all their possessions and refused to participate in the economy, the military, or the culture. The book of Acts tells us that the first Christians were persecuted for turning the world upside down. But 300 years after Jesus was executed by the Roman Empire, Emperor Constantine made Christianity the official state religion of that very same empire. Constantine was the first Christian nationalist. Pro-war, pro-wealth, pro-white supremacy. That original countercultural movement became a tranquilized, privatized, weaponized religion, the official sponsor of Western civilization. A religion of sharing became a religion of greed. A religion of peace became a religion of violence. A religion of forgiveness became a religion of judgment. A religion of ego transformation became a religion of ego affirmation. Today, Christian nationalists obsess over people's private parts while the planet burns. The Bible doesn't mention abortion or gay marriage, but it goes on and on about forgiving debt, liberating the poor, and healing the sick. Christian nationalists like to say this is a Christian nation. Not only is that historically inaccurate, not only is that theologically blasphemous, but it's also just not true. Look around us. If this was truly a Christian nation, we would forgive student debt. If this was truly a Christian nation, we would guarantee health care to every single person. If this was truly a Christian nation, we would love all of our LGBTQ neighbors. If this was truly a Christian nation, we would make sure every child in this state and in this country was housed, fed, clothed, educated, and insured. If this was truly a Christian nation, we would never make it a Christian nation, because we know the table of fellowship is open to everybody, including our Buddhist, Hindu, Jewish, Muslim, Sikh, and atheist neighbors. Jesus could have started a Christian theocracy, but love would never do that. The closest thing we have to the kingdom of heaven is a multiracial, multicultural democracy where power is truly shared among all people, something that's yet to exist in human history.
And that was Texas State Representative James Del Tallarico. Next, we have Reverend Stephen Anderson asking if Israel is really our ally.
But then one would say, well, but, you know, they're our only ally in the Middle East. Let's stop and talk about that little pronoun, our. What do you mean by that, our ally? Is Israel my ally? Is Israel Stephen Anderson's ally in the Middle East? Okay, is Israel the ally of Faithful Word Baptist Church in the Middle East? Okay, is Israel just going to bat for Arizonans in the Middle East? What does that mean, they're our ally? You know what they really mean is that they're the ally of the U.S. military in the Middle East. Well, let me explain something to you. I don't give a rip about the interests of the U.S. military in the Middle East, because the U.S. military has no business being in the Middle East. We should be defending ourselves and not nation building and empire building all over the world. So what you really mean is that Israel is a great ally of the military industrial complex. Okay, that's what you mean. Because they're certainly not my ally. They're certainly not Jesus' ally or our church's ally or the ally of the interests of people who live in Arizona. Okay, so I identify as a Christian. I identify as a citizen of Arizona. Okay, I identify as a person living in America.
And that was the Reverend Stephen Anderson. Next, we have historian Christine Hayes on the linguistic distinction between Israeli and Israelite.
One thing that kept cropping up, and it's something that crops up every time I teach this course, and I should always say something about it preemptively, it's just a terminological issue. Israelites are not Israelis. The word Israeli, term Israeli, refers to a citizen of the modern state of Israel. So there are no Israelis before the year 1948. Okay, and we use Israelite to refer to the ancient inhabitants of the ancient kingdom of Israel. Okay, so that's an important distinction, and I know you hear Israelis, and so that's just a term that people thought would apply to anyone who inhabited a place called Israel, but Israeli and Israelite are used precisely in order to make that distinction between the ancient and the modern period. Okay, so we're talking about Israelites, and while we're on this subject, we're not talking about Jews yet either. We can't really use the term Jew. It's not historically accurate for the period that we've been dealing with in the Bible. When we get towards the very end of the biblical period, and we see that when Persia conquers and reconstitutes this area or designates as a province this area as Yehud, right? So the Persians are going to be the ones to create a province called Yehud in this area, including Jerusalem, and they will allow the Israelites who are in exile to go back and live there, and they will become Yehudites. And this is going to be where the word Jew comes from, but that's not going to be historically accurate before the end of the 6th century, okay? So, and even then, it's still a technical term having to do with living in the province of Yehud. It's not an ethnic term, right? The word Yehud or Jew doesn't become an ethnic term for quite some time.
And that was Texas State Representative James Del Tallarico. Next, we have Reverend Stephen Anderson asking if Israel is really our ally. And that was the Reverend Stephen Anderson. Next, we have historian Christine Hayes on the linguistic distinction between Israeli and Israelite. And that was historian Christine Hayes. Next, an Al Jazeera documentary about the Stern Gang. And that was Al Jazeera's documentary about the Stern Gang. And next, a commentary by Rich Forer about once being an AIPAC Zionist, but he's now a pro-Palestinian activist. So here's Rich Forer. And that was Rich Forer. You can always check out our schedule at kpip-lp.org and then click on the weekly schedule link.
Hi, welcome. Come on in. I'm waiting for you. Come, come.
My name is Yair Stern. I'm the son of Abraham Stern Elias Yair, the founder and first commander of Lehi, an underground movement that fought the British here in Israel during the 1940s. He was killed at the age of 34 by the British in cold blood murder.
Terrorism is turning into open revolt in Palestine, and British troops and police are up against a tough proposition. With every Arab a nationalist, any apparently peaceful citizen may be carrying a bomb. And to catch a murderer in an Oriental city is like looking for a rabbit in a well-organized warren.
Abraham Stern, first of all, was a hero. He came as a student from Poland to the land of Israel in 1925 and was a brilliant student of liberal arts at the Hebrew University here on Mount Scopus. He also was a poet.
This book is a book of his poems, since he was a poet. This is book with all his poems. The first edition was in 1950.
Which one is your best poem?
The best poem is the one that I sent to you, Unknown Soldiers.
Because he wrote it, he wrote this song in the year 1932, when he was a member of the Irgun. Came back to Jerusalem and he showed it to my mother. He sang it to her because he also invented the music. And he asked my mother, do you think that the boys will love this song? And she said, of course, it's a beautiful song. Come home, and she took a note and wrote the music. And since then, the song became the anthem of the underground movement. You want me to sing it?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, I can. At least two lines. Chayalim almonim hinenu bli madim.
It's a poem of a young man during the period of great ideologies and great clashes. So it became a symbol. I think a symbol for the resistance, all kind of resistance during the 1930s and 1940s to the British mandate. And
totally expressed the devotion for having free land.
In 1929, he decided to join an organization that might protect Jews, and the only organization then was the Haganah.
The Haganah was very careful in its relationship with the British mandate authorities. Sometimes it rejected the policies, but sometimes they cooperated.
He spent some time there, but they didn't do much. He didn't like what they're doing there.
And a group of Zionists within the Haganah believed that Britain is as much the enemy of Zionism as are the Palestinians. So if you want to create the Jewish state in Palestine, you don't only have to remove the Palestinians, you have to force the British outside of Palestine. So the first group that came out of the Haganah and rejected its more careful policies towards the British was the Irgun, led by Menachem Begin and Zeev Jabotinsky.
So my father joined the Irgun, and there he understood and he started to think that his life is going to change. He will have to dedicate his life to fight for Israel.
The end of August 1939, just the day before the Second World War began, the British CID captured all the heads of the Irgun in a department in Tel Aviv. And a few months before, they captured the head of the Irgun, David Raziel. And also, on the same day when the Germans began the war, Zeev Jabotinsky decided that now the Irgun are not going to fight the British until the end of the war. And then Avraham Shteren, with some of his friends, disagree with the Jabotinsky decision, and they're going to fight the British. So Shteren decided that he's going to split from the Irgun and to establish his own group, which is called the Shteren Group. And if you want to establish a group, you need three things. You need men, you need arms, and you need money.
So they went out robbing banks, and because they were not true professionals, people got killed. And there was a great rage from most of the Jewish population against them.
The British authorities here, and mainly the British police in Tel Aviv, they were in panic from the Lehi actions, because Lehi was killing and wounding many British soldiers, British officers. And they thought that if they will kill Stern, the underground will die with him. So there was a hunt. It's a simple story. Two of his soldiers were injured and being treated in a Jaffa hospital. And one day the mother of one of the injured came to visit, and she told the other one, his name was Moshe Svorai, that she wants to go and visit his wife, but she doesn't know the address. And he told her the address in Hebrew.
And Svorai's wife, in the most naive and probably not a very professional conduct, was giving shelter to Stern. And when this information was tracked down by the British intelligence, the next thing they would do was to go and see what's going on there.
The one that discovered him was an officer named Thomas Wilkin. But he didn't shoot. He called his superior, this guy, Major Morton, and Morton did the killing. My father was tied in his hands, and it was a cold-blood murder. Then they claimed that he tried to run away or something. That's his last letter. This is his last letter written in the morning of his death, of the killing. He says here in this last letter that I'm not one of those who give themselves up willingly to the police or to the collaborator with her from right or from left. Meaning, negative answer. I'm not leaving.
These, the first pictures permitted of Jewish refugees on their way from Cyprus to Palestine. They're some of the last 750 of the December quota, and not unnaturally, the transfer, since it's now in the direction of the Promised Land, is orderly and cheerful. Many had suffered great hardships in the past. She, for instance, was evidently once merely a number in some Nazi Belsen. Today, she has a future.
Aaron Stern is a romanticist, a poet, an ideologist. And in that sense, he was a very truthful figure of that era.
Avraham Stern, was he a terrorist or was he a misguided dreamer? My guess, no, I think he was a terrorist.
Unlike other Zionists, Stern did not lie to himself. He didn't say that Palestine was empty. But if you read his early writings, he describes the Palestinians as aliens, as foreigners. He really believed that the Palestinians were people who did not belong in Palestine and were taking over, settling in a land that belonged only to the Jews. He did not see any attachment between the Palestinians and Palestine. He saw himself as a real anti-imperialist person. So he likened himself to the anti-imperialist movements in Africa and India. And the most bizarre thing is not how he saw the British. Okay, the British were an empire, but how he saw the Palestinians as part of the British Empire, which was totally distortion of the history, of the reality, but that was his world.
He wanted to fight the British in order to gain independence. Stern, in his utter naivety, believed he could form an alliance with Hitler against the British.
Hold on a second. I'll tell you exactly what happened. Yes, he did think that if he will find an agreement with the Nazis, he could save Jews. He wanted to make an agreement with the Nazis so that the Nazis will send or let the Jews from Europe come here to Israel and be safe. And in addition, the Lehi will help the Germans by fighting the British. So he wrote a suggestion and he sent a messenger to Beirut in Lebanon to the German embassy. And the messenger gave this letter and this offer to the German ambassador in Beirut. And that was the end of it. He never got any answer, no reaction, no nothing. This is the end, the beginning and the end of the collaboration with the Nazis.
It was a very naive way of thinking because the Germans never answered it. This naive attempt was never evolved. There was never any kind of cooperation. There were some strange dreams of fighting together the mutual enemy. Nothing serious could have come out of it.
I'm going to hand you some document that prove that your dad did cooperate with the Nazi, and did he have a knowledge that the Nazi were treating the Jews very badly in Europe?
These are protocols of an interrogation made by Haganah people, the main yeshuv establishment, to a young man that was part of the Stern people. And they asked him what were the ideas of making some kind of apply to Germany. It was never a cooperation. That's thoughts.
One of them was tortured very strongly, Ephraim Zettler, by the British. And I think that under torture, he told them whatever they wanted to hear. And the other one, Polanyi, is a guy that was in the leadership of Lehi. And once the British put on the walls of all the streets in Tel Aviv, pictures of wanted leaders of the Lehi. My father was, they wanted to pay for him 1,000 sterling, which was a huge sum of money there. He ran to a kibbutz called Maalei HaMisha, not far from Jerusalem. He had friends there and he was hiding there. And there he told them whatever they wanted to hear. But there's no legs to this lie. I mean, as I told you, the only collaboration was with this ambassador in Beirut. Came out with nothing. And also, Stern couldn't know about the Holocaust because the Wannsee Convention, where all the Nazi leadership conferred and decided about the final solution for the Jews, was in the 20th of January, 1942. Stern was killed on February 12th, 1942, 3 weeks later. He was then under hunt. He was living in parks, in shelters. He didn't know anything about what's going on in Europe, not about the Wannsee Convention, and not about the extermination of Jews. He couldn't know.
He definitely knew that Jews already for 7 years or 8 years before were under a very racist legal regime that boycotted the Jewish businesses. The Jews were thrown out of universities, civil service. This was a few years after the Kristallnacht, when Jewish synagogues were burned hundreds of Jews were killed in pogroms. He knew very well about this Nazi incitement to their own society. I don't think he knew about extermination camps and so on, but he definitely knew that the Nazis were using very cruel anti-Semitic means in order to force the Jews outside of Germany. But, you know, forcing the Jews out of Germany for Stern was something that he wanted to happen anyway.
Haganah and the mainstream Zionists, and even Egon, realized you had to wait for the defeat of the Nazis before you could then take on the British. It was a question of tactics, it wasn't a question of principle. So the idea that you negotiate with the Nazis, of course, was acceptable. In 1933, they negotiated Havarah, the transfer agreement, a trade agreement with the Nazis that broke the Jewish boycott of Nazi Germany. So again, there was no difference in principle, but tactically, you could see that Stern was again impatient. He couldn't wait. He couldn't see that sometimes you can't do everything at once.
In Rome, a Nazi flag flies and a wreath is laid at the tomb of the Italian unknown soldier. 500 members of the so-called Hitler Youth march past in demonstration of the newly established accord between Germany and Italy. And who takes the salute? Don't tell me, I shall recognize him presently. A significant visit. Germany and Italy, Nazis and fascists draw together.
Many of the Zionist leaders, not only Avraham Stern, went through this famous maxim, my enemy's enemy is my friend. And some of them, and again, not only the Stern gang, were also very nationalist in a way. Even Ben-Gurion, still in 36, 37, were quite fascinated by fascism as an ideology. Stern totally disregarded the anti-Jewish side of fascism. He was so focused on trying to build an alliance against the British that he was only thinking about this maxim, the enemies of my enemies, my friend. So in 1940, he tries to, first of all, to meet the fascists from Italy.
They made a kind of an agreement, which called the Jerusalem Agreement, made by the Stern Group, which said that he is going to be one side, and Italia will be the other side.
He agreed to recognize the Italian fascists as being the sovereign power in most of the region, while the Italian fascists would recognize Stern as and Lehi as the sole sovereign power in historic Palestine. But one of the most interesting parts of the agreement was that it required the Italian fascists to use their military power to dissolve what they referred to as the Jewish diaspora, meaning that Stern wanted the fascist military to forcibly remove Jews who were not in Palestine and make them go to Palestine. The problem was that, unbeknownst to Stern, these messages had been intercepted by his rivals at the Irgun. And for a while, he was actually communicating, unbeknownst to him, with the Irgun rather than with the Italian fascists.
Another step by the Irgun to show that the Stern was a gangster, was a quisling, was a traitor.
I would like to say that the first one to cooperate with the Nazis was Haji Amin al-Husseini in 1936. much time before World War II.
Haji Amin al-Husseini was meeting Hitler, I think for many reasons. First of all, he knew that Hitler is fighting against the British. And Haji Amin al-Husseini didn't like the British because they kicked him out of Palestine. From the Jewish point of view, it was like he was a traitor, like that he met Hitler. As I think now, he do it from his own point of view, from his own will. There was no Arab state. And as I said before, it wasn't only him. Many people tried to meet Hitler, see what happened with the Vatican, with the Pope. The Shemites are Jews and Arabs as well. So to tell him that it was against the Jews in Palestine, I think, because it was afraid that if we will have Jews in Palestine, it wasn't be good for the Arabs in Palestine. It had nothing to do with the anti-Semitic.
That was a really great mistake, absolutely. But whereas it's understandable for the Mufti to have taken that position, for a so-called Jewish movement to have taken it, knowing full well that the Nazis had come to power on an anti-Jewish program, and with Hitler had said that in the event of war, the Jews would be annihilated in Europe, it was utter madness. It was treason of the first order.
The British authorities here, and mainly the British police in Tel Aviv, thought that once they killed him, that's the end of the terrorist organization called Lehi. Of course, they were wrong.
From Haifa come pictures showing the result of the recent outrage that shattered the brief lull in terrorist activity. The incident was caused by a man, believed by some to be one of the Stern gang this time, driving a stolen van full of explosives to quarters where it blew up. Two British and two Arab policemen were killed, and others are reported missing. More than 60 police, soldiers and civilians were injured.
The three people who took over from him, I think they were much more organized than he was, and much more systematic in what they did. Yes, part of what they did was a revenge, but part of what they did was understanding that actually attacking British installation, assassinating British officers, intimidating Jews who were not aggressive enough in their hands or what they would call collaborated with the British, was a terror campaign that was far better organized, I think, under the three people that took over from Stern.
Violent actions that took life, both Jews and British. Then the decision was very strict. We must hunt down those people, and if we can't do that ourselves, we're going to hand them over to the British to deal with.
I think what is important to understand in the relationship between the Irgun and Stern Gang after 43 is that they have a new enemy. Not only Britain, not only the Palestinians, but also the Haganah. The Haganah begins a campaign of trying to undermine the power of the Irgun and the Stern Gang. In Zionist historiography, this period is called the saison, the French word for the period, and also the hunting period.
It was mainly done was the by the Haganah and people from the Palmach. And as far as I know, they didn't give so many people to the British, but they stopped the terror.
רוב הבריחות היו מפחד, שהתגבר אחרי מקרה דיר יסין, אין ספק. אין ספק שדיר יסין זה משהו חותך, עובדה, השבועים שלנו, כשהעבירו אותם מהגוש לחברון, מה צרקו להם בדרך? דיר יסין, דיר יסין. זאת אומרת, דיר יסין הגביר את הפחד.
The massacre in Deir Yassin on the 9th of April 1948 was actually perpetrated by all three military, paramilitary groups or gangs. But Ben-Gurion was very clever. Immediately after the massacre, he said it was committed by the Irgun and the Stern Gang, and even wrote a letter to King Abdullah in Jordan apologizing for the behavior of the extremists in my own army.
Deir Yassin was a harsh action when you put it in context as part of a war. But Lehi has nothing to do with Deir Yassin. Deir Yassin was an action of Etzel people.
בשיחות עם אנשי אצל, עם אנשי ואנשי לחי, הם חושבים שזה היה נכון לעשות את זה. זאת אומרת, הם לא מצדיקים, לדעתי, לא מצדיקים את הטבח בדיר יסין, אבל הם חושבים זה, שדיר יסין זה היה דבר חשוב להגדיל את הפחד ושיברחו.
But we should mention, of course, Deir Yassin was not the only massacre. It was not even the worst massacre. The Zionists themselves summarized the means by which they expelled the Palestinians. So it's a very detailed document that says we used expulsion. We used rumors to frighten the people. We used special bombardments to make people afraid. This is not just a document that says what we will do, this is a document that already says what we have done. It debunks one of the most important Israeli myths. The Israeli myth that many people in the world still accept today is that on the 15th of May 1948, the Arab world sent its armies to Palestine to destroy the Jewish state. It told the Palestinians to leave, and the Palestinians became refugees because the Arab world started a war on the 15th of May 1948. No. What this document shows that even before one Arab soldier entered Palestine on the 15th of May 1948, according to the Israeli, to the Zionist intelligence, the Zionist forces expelled hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. The war was used in order to continue the ethnic cleansing that began before the war. But I think what is really important here is to understand that the Arab armies are entering Palestine in order to stop the ethnic cleansing, much more than to destroy the Jewish state.
Meanwhile, the United Nations mediator has reported to the Security Council. Greeted by Mr. Trygve Lie in New York, Count Bernadard said,
"And I believe, and I think I have the right to believe, that we sooner or later, it might be sooner, can get a settlement and stop the war in Palestine."
During the Second World War, the Stern Gang does not see eye to eye with the Irgun and the Haganah and operates alone against British targets. Once the war is over, the three paramilitary groups of Zionism, Haganah, Irgun, and the Stern Gang, create something they called in Hebrew Tnu'at HaMeri, the rebellion movement or the revolt movement. And they start to coordinate actions against Palestinians and against the British. And because the Stern Gang is not very large in numbers, They operate geographically mainly in two areas, in Jerusalem and in Jaffa.
Its principal preoccupation was assassinations. And the most notorious assassination of the period, the assassination of the UN mediator, Count Bernadotte, was committed by Lehi operatives.
Bernadotte was in many ways a hero. He'd saved far more people than the Zionists had from the concentration camps, that's for sure.
He was appointed a few days after the end of the British mandate.
The reason why the UN asked Bernadotte to negotiate the crisis in Palestine was twofold. One was that he was widely respected as a fair-minded peacemaker. But the other reason is that he had saved 30,000 Jews from the Nazi extermination camps. And therefore, the UN thought that the Zionists would respect what he would recommend.
His first mission was to obtain a truce, which he did on the 9th of June. But he was more ambitious than that.
When the Security Council of the United Nations met in Paris, Sir Alexander Cadogan, its president, spoke for the delegates.
The Security Council is met here today under the shadow of the terrible news from Palestine of the murder of the United Nations mediator, Count Bernadotte.
In a way, he was not seen as favorable for the Zionist cause or for the young Israeli cause. Even though murdering him was not an option by the mainstream Israel, it was not part of the new sovereign Israel.
His assassination was ordered by Yitzhak Shamir, who was twice Prime Minister of Israel.
על הקמת מדינה יהודית בארץ ישראל, היא מדינת ישראל.
The Stern Gang, it starts with trying to be more assertive already in Europe in defending Jewish communities from anti-Semitic attacks. And that's where they become more physical, if you want, in their a wish to create a Jew that is not just a victim of pogroms and anti-Semitism, but one who can defend himself. And I think that's the part I could relate to, you know, as a Jew today. I can understand it. You don't want to be all the time under attacks of Christians in Europe who attack you just because you are a Jew. The problem was that they took this violence that they learned, and Stern was very important in this, and said, well, this experience of violence should now be used in order to enhance our takeover of Palestine.
The Zionist does not massacre innocent people by the ideology. It's not part of the way. People would do harsh things, but not as part of the main ideology. The Zionist movement always saw itself as a civilized movement.
Zionism claims to speak on behalf of all Jewish people, regardless of whether they agree with them or not. It's a nationalist movement of the most right-wing and racist type. So Jews who are not Zionists are called self-haters. ironically, I mean, this is what the Nazis called the Germans who were anti-fascist, that he, literally, they hated themselves because they hated their own race and nation. And that's the same idea that Zionism has, that if you are an anti-Zionist, you hate your race, because Zionism considers Jews a race at the bottom, and therefore you hate yourself, because the individual is not important compared to the race that you belong to. I mean, this is the racist philosophy, of course.
Yes, Palestine was hijacked, and not only Palestine itself, but Jewish identity was hijacked by the Zionists in order to support their project. It may at first seem inexplicable that the same people that had survived the horrors of the Holocaust might then dehumanize other people in Palestine and wipe out one village after another because of people's ethnicity. Now, how do we explain this? The Nazi identity was being systematically transferred by the Zionists from the Nazis onto the Palestinians. This was used in order to shield the consciences of people who had survived the camps, then were brought to Palestine as settlers, and, as we know, engaged in this horrific crime against an ethnicity. One need not make any comparisons between the Holocaust and what happened in the Palestine. In Palestine, I think to do that is, it misses the point. One shouldn't even need to compare what happened to the under the hands of the Germans to understand that what happened in Palestine was a grotesque crime against humanity.
There's a medal that I have received to the from the Ministry of Defense of Israel for my father for taking part in the war. But it came many, many years after he deserved it. This state was created in blood and sweat and many victims, but the role of Lehi is being the first and the most activist and the most extremist underground that started the fight against the foreign occupier.
The current government behaves as if it's a Stern gang, still fighting, but has all the power that the Stern gang did not have of a state. And nowadays in Israel, we have a small civil war because half of the Israeli Jewish community, not because of any love of the Palestinians or because they understand how bad the colonialism and occupation of Israel is, but they don't like the Stern gang ideology of the government. So we have now a small civil war inside the Jewish society because, again, there's this idea of among some Zionists that maybe you can do Zionism without the Stern Gang ideology. My own understanding is that you have only two options. Either you have a state without Zionism, or if you have a state with Zionism, it will look like the Stern Gang Zionism.
A key reason why the Zionists wanted a state wasn't simply for the land. It was because statehood speaks from a different podium than non-state groups. In the world as it is, the nation state is the measure of all things. Therefore, the Palestinians had to be prevented from having a state so that they did not have the same voice. In other words, on May 15th of 1948, what had been Israeli terrorists, people like Begin and Shamir, all these people, they now became whitewashed by the mentality of the nation state. They became freedom fighters who maybe they acted in excessive ways before that, but this is now a nation state abiding allegedly by international law, and it's a whole different state of mind that the world looks at them with.
We still have to believe as a society, as a human society, that states which are built on Abraham Stern's view of statehood will not survive in the end of the day. Because if they do, it means that morality has no place in humanity. Maybe it's true, but that would be a very sad conclusion. So it's a guidelines for how to build a state in an immoral world.
And that was Texas State Representative James Del Tallarico. Next we have Reverend Stephen Anderson asking if Israel is really our ally. And that was the Reverend Stephen Anderson. Next we have historian Christine Hayes on the linguistic distinction between Israeli and Israelite. And that was historian Christine Hayes. Next, an Al Jazeera documentary about the Stern Gang. And that was Al Jazeera's documentary about the Stern Gang. And next, a commentary by Rich Forer about once being an AIPAC Zionist, but he's now a pro-Palestinian activist. So here's Rich Forer. And that was Rich Forer. You can always check out our schedule at kpip-lp.org and then click on the weekly schedule link.
I wasn't going to trust that a non-Jewish author could be honest or not anti-Semitic. This is how radical I was. So I went to the library, got a few books, came home. The next day I started reading, and maybe about a week after reading fairly uninteresting material that didn't really address my concerns that much, I started reading Norman Finkelstein's Beyond Chutzpah on the misuse of anti-Semitism and the abuse of history. I had never heard of Finkelstein, and I just said, I don't believe that. The Jewish professor must have been confused, or maybe he's a self-hating Jew. So I started reading Finkelstein's book, and what happened was, I knew immediately that he was a brilliant man. And everything he said, his criticism was only directed towards Israel. There was no criticism of the Palestinian people at all, or the Arab side. And I was wondering, well, when's he going to speak out about the Arabs? But I couldn't put the book down because, number one, I'd committed myself to really studying the history as objectively as I could. And number two, I recognized in the first paragraph of the book that he was a brilliant man. Somehow I recognized that. So I kept reading. Plus, he documented all of his claims very meticulously. So his sources were organizations like Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, B'Tselem, the Israeli human rights organization. And so I was reading and reading and reading. And as I was reading, I would go look online for the sources that he was citing in his book. So I go to the papers that Amnesty International for example, that they had written on the subject. And I would look for the quotes he had taken from them. I was hoping that I would find him taking the quotes out of context or changing a word here or there to misrepresent what the organization was saying. Unfortunately, sort of, at least from that prior point of view, he was, everything he said was impeccable. There was nothing that he was beyond reproach. So I continued reading, and at a certain point I was so absorbed in what I was reading that I allowed all the emotions that were going through me. I didn't resist at all. So I was going through shock at what I was reading. Oh my God, I've supported Israel all these years. This is what Israel's doing. Oh my God. And then anger at Israel for misguiding me all my life and getting me to support the maltreatment of Palestinians. Then my anger turned in on itself and I got angry at me for being such a dupe and being so ignorant and never checking anything out. And then shame and embarrassment arose. And then finally a great sorrow for the Palestinian people for all that they had been through.
And that was Rich Forer. You can always check out our schedule at kpip-lp.org and then click on the link for the weekly schedule.